This podcast deals with sensitive topics such as drug abuse, domestic violence, and murder, and may not be suitable for all audiences. I'm your host, Liz Rose. I quickly wanted to start off with an apology and an update. First, the apology for the unexpected and unannounced break. Both Stephanie and I had our share of crises that required our immediate attention, which also caused the need to reevaluate the case that we've been questioning, the case of Ivan Ken too. After a lot of back and forth, weighing pros and cons, while also trying to juggle raising my kids, struggling with a lupus flare, and continuing to work on the case of my parents, Jim and Sandy Melgar, we've decided that it's probably best to end the current season over the next 2 to 4 episodes. I had originally and vocally started this podcast with the decision that I would only tell the truth due to a tangled web of lies and deceit, while also leaving out the drama that ensued after I became deeply involved with the Cantu family and Ivan's case. Stephanie and I had decided that by covering this as our first case in question, we could learn what it takes to put together and host a podcast, which has truly been much more difficult than we had ever expected or given podcasters credit for. We had definitely been thrown in the deep end and had to learn to swim quickly. However, we figured that this was the best way to get all the wrinkles out and find some experience in order to cover my parents' case in the next season and in order to do it justice, since that's something we've never actually received. We struggled with recording from two different states, with learning how to write and tell a coherent story between two people, and with hiding our own disdain for the lies and smear campaigns that had been launched against me by both Ivan's wife and Ivan's mother. While I will always stand by my promise to tell the absolute truth, especially since all I have are my reputation and my word, I've decided to tell the whole story, drama and all, in order to conclude this chapter and move on to cases that are more deserving of the time and energy required to help someone in need. I honestly have struggled to continue with this case when there are so many people that are truly wrongfully convicted and not just claiming to be so, though there are plenty of those, as we have seen in Ivan Ken too. It has been an exercise in patience to fairly speak of Ivan and his family when they have continued to lie and manipulate at every turn. And as we said from the start, we can back up the accusations we've leveled, and we will. And I'll explain more about that in just a bit. The amount of time it takes to do the research, write, and record the episodes while also taking precious time away from my family is not a small amount of time. I know that there are many of you out there that not only listen, but put hours of your own time reading and investigating on behalf of the subjects of podcasts because you truly believe in the cause and want to make a difference. It's people like you that have changed the lives of the wrongfully convicted, people who truly deserve your time, your resources, and helping clear their names. It pains me to say that Ivan is not one of those deserving people. I also feel it's important to once again clarify where I stand on the death penalty. I am not by any means a supporter of the death penalty, but I will admit that before my dad's murder and my mom's wrongful conviction, I was rather indifferent, as I hadn't spent much time thinking about it since I had no experience or knowledge of the absolute mess of a system we have the audacity to call the justice system, especially when it is anything but. Absolutely and unequivocally believe we do not have any right to take a person's life. What makes the difference between murdering someone in cold blood on the street and then murdering the murderer as some form of deterrence and punishment in a government setting? Not only does it cost exponentially more to house a prisoner on death row than it does to house a prisoner in general population for life, but we know it doesn't act as a deterrent, We know that there are far too many wrongful convictions and unanswered questions in criminal cases to make the decision of who goes to a prison cell and who goes to the execution chamber. I strongly believe in the saying, an eye for an eye and the whole world goes blind. And I intend to live by my own words if my father's murderers are ever brought to justice. My father's murder is a capital murder case. We were reminded of this many times by the police, like some sort of threat. However, I will ask for them to be shown the mercy that they were unable to show my dad, because I just can't understand how execution is justice for anyone. I only say this so you can see that I don't want to see anyone die. I don't want to see Ivan Cantu die. I wish that Ivan would talk. I wish that he would show some remorse and provide information on those that I know he's protecting in order to try and work out a deal for life in prison, to spare his life even though he was incapable of sparing his own cousins. I want people to know this. I am not here to hurry him into the execution chamber by any means. That is the last thing I want. I started this podcast out of necessity. Yes, I wanted to practice for telling my parents' story, which was the one upside to this, but the main reason was that I desperately needed and wanted to clear my name after being a vocal advocate for this case, helping them gain publicity and listeners and attaching my name to this. I need to rebuild my credibility and confidence while telling the truth and finding answers to the case that had never been provided. Therefore, as we have provided the trial transcripts and relevant documents, we have decided to share what the Cantu family claims they are not being given. Ivan's mother, Sylvia Cantu, and the person he calls his wife, Tammy Pelliser Cantu, have shared a petition many times and stated that Collin County's district attorney refuses to provide them with the case binders and evidence. However, upon spending countless hours speaking with Sylvia and the private investigator / television producer Matt Duff, or Wayne Dunn as he calls himself when trying to gain access to those that knew James Mosqueda and Amy Kitchen, I proved that I was capable and knowledgeable in investigating a wrongful conviction in Texas. I was quickly provided with the case files that I had been told were being unfairly held from Ivan in order to maintain an innocent man on death row in some strange, ever-changing, and nonsensical conspiracy. Thanks to the moderators of the podcast group, we were able to redact any private information in these case files in order to publish them on both the Question the Case website and the Question the Case podcast Facebook group. These binders are the investigative file that was assorted by the lead detective, Anthony Nguyen. It is essentially every document used to make the case against Ivan Cantu. There are statements, prior offenses, and criminal history warrants, arrest reports, and even a report on the final interview Ivan gave the lead detective after his arrest. It was then that he was found to have the Corvette key on his person and ended the interview by asking for a lawyer when he was informed that an identical pair of Arizona jeans, the same type and size found with blood on them in his kitchen trash can, were found in his apartment closet. I think the best way to summarize the story is to start at the beginning. Before we dive in, I just want to summarize this episode. I want to quickly run through the evidence, the sequence of events, and kind of touch on what I believe happened based on the case files and speaking to friends and family members of both Ivan Cantu and James Mosqueda. If you have any questions, and if there's anything I've missed, please feel free to email me at questionthecase@gmail.com or through questionthecase.com. It's important to point out that the Parridge apartment that Amy Boettcher and Ivan were living in was only under Amy Boettcher's name, and not both Amy and Ivan. This seems like it lends truth to what those closely involved have been saying, that Ivan had been planning this crime for at least a month in advance. Not only had he asked Amy Boettcher's brother, Jeff, to be part of the cleanup crew, but the reason he gave Amy to put the apartment solely in her name was that he needed to act poor while he was committing mortgage scams. Hindsight being 2020, it seems clear to me now that this was most likely an attempt to avoid any search warrants, since he would not be on the lease and would technically not be considered a resident. However, we can see he was mistaken. This is discussed a bit in the jailhouse tapes, which you can find on a YouTube channel called Chasing Truth, and that's all one word. You can search for videos posted in May 2020 on this particular channel, and I'll provide the links in the show notes and on the website. The YouTube channel, Chasing Truth, records themselves listening to and discussing the fallacious podcast that is currently covering Ivan's case. There you can find the original podcast as it was originally released. As you may or may not know, that podcast has been repeatedly edited to fit Ivan Cantu's narrative, without accounting for any of the changes it makes. What you will hear is one of the earliest versions of the Cousins by Blood podcast, which is almost unrecognizable to what has most recently been released. Even my own voice translating Spanish into English for that podcast and any work that I did on their behalf has been completely erased, and I can see why. Ivan keeps telling the crazy story of the pizza man, a pizza man that forced his way into Ivan's apartment and threatened him at gunpoint in order to get Ivan to go back to work with James closing loans. All this before firing a round over Ivan's head and into the wall behind him, next to the open front door. However, two neighbors in two different apartments testified in court to hearing the gunshots, followed by a woman screaming and yelling that she was bleeding, but nothing about a homicidal John Travolta wearing a trench coat and a ponytail before taking off in a black Lincoln Town Car. I think it's worth mentioning here that both Amy and Ivan had a novel way of keeping track of their deceptions. They always seemed to base it in some morsel of truth in order to not trip themselves up later down the line. But I say this because it's useful in detangling truth from lies. According to those that I've spoken to that were close to James and Ivan, Ivan loved mafia movies, and it certainly shows in his retelling of events. I do believe that someone was after someone else, perhaps a drug dealer after Ivan, because money was owed. I doubt it was more than a few hundred to $1,000, which was about what Smiley gave Ivan. $800 to $1,500, depending on which account you listen to. While I was working with Matt Duff / Wayne Dunn, the private investigator and podcast producer, I was allowed to hear one of Smiley's interviews. Unfortunately, this interview has disappeared and is no longer included in the interviews and jailhouse tapes that were originally released. Luckily, you can still hear them at Chasing Truth, and that's again one word, on YouTube. Ivan and Amy Betcher both admit to going to Club 7. Amy B. says Ivan makes a drug deal, returns to Smiley's, and gives Smiley some money back before going off to party and trade drugs. Both Smiley and Amy have told this story in court and in interviews to the producer of Cousins by Blood. I always wondered if Smiley had knowledge of the murders beforehand, but unfortunately we may never know. Ivan claims to have returned the Corvette to James at 6:30 a.m. while also claiming the 11:15 a.m. toll tag hit was the murderers driving the Corvette, and not Ivan himself. Amy Betcher has admitted it was them. It fits their timeline, returning from partying at Metals. After speaking with Ivan's mom, Sylvia Cantu, she made a mistake and admitted to me that Ivan and Amy still have the car and made those hits before leaving for Arkansas around noon. Her conversations and recordings of them will be made available in the Facebook group and the website questionthecase.com. Ivan is adamant he returned the Corvette at 6:30 a.m. The Corvette didn't get tagged as missing until 9 or 10 p.m. the night James and Amy Kitchen were found. Someone from the dealership called the police around 10 p.m. after watching the news to let them know the Corvette was equipped with a low jack. The car wasn't found until 3 a.m. A map of where it was in relation to Ivan and Amy Betcher's apartment will be provided at Question the Case podcast group and the website. Gladys Mosqueda, James's mother, had asked to spend the night at James's house as her car wasn't working and she needed a ride to work. James said no because he was having Ivan over and he knew that his family would not be happy to know this, as they had asked him not to associate with Ivan anymore. Again, I have recording of the conversation between Gladys and Sylvia that Mrs. Cantu has provided to me, and this will also be released. During the time I worked with Matt Duff on his podcast, I helped him translate as my first language is Spanish. I helped him call the gardener that was working for James Mosqueda at that time and translated the phone call. The gardener is told by James that his cousin Ivan is newly divorced and was having a hard time, so he would be staying at James's house. James then asked the gardener to come at another time. Several family members have also said that Ivan gave James some sob story in order to stay the night at James's house. He waited for them to go to sleep, for an accomplice, perhaps both, before making the move to kill them. The guest room was in disarray, most likely because Ivan slept in that bed, which you can see in the crime scene photos, which we will make available on the website and Facebook. However, we will not be showing the more gruesome ones or of the victims themselves out of respect for the families. Ivan pretends to sleep in the bed and leaves his boots in that bedroom. Amy Betcher even testifies in court that they went back to look for his boots, although whether they find them or not is still unknown. Family later found and described the boots, brown boots that were a size 9.5, which I later confirm is Ivan's shoe size. If we go back to the beginning, we also see a pattern of strange behavior from Ivan and his mother. His mother shows up at the crime scene rather quickly, not long after the firemen make entry, but before the police show up and the bodies are removed. Sylvia is actually the one that calls James's family and alerts them to his death. The family has long questioned how it was that she was there so soon and how she knew before any of them. When I asked her this question, she claims that a man named Ray Sanchez called her at 5:15 p.m. to let her know about the murders. He asks her to go check because he was with his newborn baby and couldn't go himself. Sylvia has also told me that she had a bad feeling and felt the urge to drive by. We know that at this time, Amy Kitchen's mom calls the fire department. So how did Sanchez know so early? When I spoke with him, he claims he saw the news. However, according to police records and testimony at trial, the news didn't set up until after 5:15. Sylvia calls Kelly, James Mosqueda's sister, and tells her about James's death. Kelly's husband and his family hear the conversation, as the answering machine had already picked up. I know Sylvia had alleged that she spoke to Kelly's husband, and he acted unfazed and unsurprised at the news that James had been murdered by what may have been a rival drug dealer. However, after speaking with Kelly and her husband, they state that none of this actually happened. It turns out that on that day, everyone found out from Sylvia through a conversation overheard on the answering machine. Kelly and her family are the ones that call their mother to break the bad news once she arrives at the house. The family have always wondered how Sylvia knew before anyone, soon enough to be the bearer of bad news. Once at the crime scene, Sylvia suddenly becomes concerned for Ivan's welfare and begins to try and reach him. She did know that Ivan had plans to go out of town early that morning and should already be on his way to see Amy's parents, but becomes understandably worried when she can't reach him. Police testify in Volume 4 that Sylvia began to try and pull other cops away from the crime scene in order to do a well check at Ivan's home. She continuously asks different officers to accompany her to Ivan's apartment. They all let her know they need to finish first what they are doing and get permission from their captain. Eventually, Sylvia finally gets two officers to accompany her to Ivan's apartment for a well check. They arrive at Ivan's apartment. Two cops go in for 5 or 10 minutes, according to them, to do a quick search. When asked in court what they were looking for, Officer Younger testifies that they are only looking in places where a body can be concealed in order to be sure that no crime has occurred, or that no one has been hurt, and that Ivan is okay. After searching the apartment, the police then call Sylvia inside in order to provide her with some peace of mind. Sylvia then goes in. She puts her purse down on the kitchen and stands there, by the phone, looking through the caller ID under the watchful eye of the two police officers. The officers testify that Sylvia takes out her cell phone and seems to compare numbers with those on the caller ID. They begin to leave, and as they escort her out for the security guard to lock up, Sylvia waits a few minutes in her car and then goes back a second time and asks to check the caller ID once more. The cops ask the security guard to let her in again. This entire time, the police do not allow Sylvia to leave their sight while she is in there checking the caller ID. The officers testify that she did make a phone call, and the phone bill supports it. There are several points of contention during the well check visit. There are things they claim point to Ivan's innocence, one being a strange phone call that shows up on the bill, but we later learn this call was actually made by Sylvia, as we just said. The second is the trash can in which the bloody blue jeans were found. It is said that the trash can did not have a lid on it, so Mrs. Cantu would have seen the clothes in it, especially as Ivan was someone that cleaned and emptied his trash before leaving town. However, in the crime scene photo, it does show that the trash can did have a lid on it. While Sylvia, Ivan, and Ivan's wife Tammy have continuously claimed that the murderer made the strange call, the time of the call matches the time Sylvia made a phone call under the watchful eye of the police. They have always neglected to mention going back into the apartment and instead claim the murderers waited 5 minutes for the police to leave before going into Ivan and Amy's apartment to plant evidence and make a 1 minute phone call. Problem with this is that the call was made during the time Sylvia and the police were there. I've often wondered, what if this well check was just an excuse to try and remove the clothing that was placed in the kitchen trash can instead of a dumpster outside? Except the opportunity never presented itself, even after asking to go back in a second time. I only entertain this question after seeing the lengths Ivan's supporters have gone through to twist this narrative. Going back to the call, the number the call was made to belongs to a family friend of Ivan and Sylvia's. This person had a trucking company, somebody that Sylvia says was a mentor to Ivan, and had a daughter that Ivan had dated for a short amount of time. Sylvia herself confirms this in an email she sent me when I first became involved in their case, and I will also post a screenshot on Facebook and the website. This person calls back at 9 or 9:30 a.m. the next morning, apologizing for missing the call, asked for Ivan to return his call, and then leaves his phone number, which matches the number on the bill. This seems to put an end to that so-called mystery. This is something they have tried to put on Anthony Fonseca and Carlos Gonzalez. Neither of them dated the man's daughter, but it has been alleged that the call was made in order to find someone to smuggle Ivan out of the country. This has been alleged by several different people, so I thought I would share that with you as well, as we can't really put anything past Ivan. The producer of this podcast, which claims to prove Ivan's innocence, Matt Duff, a.k.a. Wayne Dunn, claims to have managed to get an interview with a responding female officer that was at the well check with Officer Younger. I believe her name is Susan Eichner, or Susan Eilif, as she later married and changed her name. They had her sign an affidavit in which she stated the lid was on the trash can and was closed at the time of the search. This is why no one can say the clothes were already in there at that time or placed in there at another time. The lid was on that trash can, and the photos seem to support that. Another issue raised by Sylvia is that there was a large box of beers by the trash can and a couple of cans of beer on the counter. However, Ivan wrote in his statements that he and Amy Betcher opened a couple of cans of beer but then left them on the counter in case they were pulled over in order to avoid any DWIs. The box against the trash can is from the night out with Melanie Li'ikala and her husband. In Melanie's testimony, she states that they brought back a pack of beer and a bottle of wine while sitting around talking about mortgages, as Ivan had offered to help them secure a home loan. We know during all this time, Ivan and Amy were on their way to visit Amy's family in Arkansas, a trip they had been planning for well over a month. After listening to the YouTube channel Chasing Truth, which is coverage of the podcast Cousins by Blood, and I mention this because they have a version of Cousins by Blood, which is a very early version and was released before the current narrative was formed. The interview with Amy Betcher's stepfather, Richard Kramer, seems to provide a little bit more information. He states that Amy was red in the face and looks as though she had been crying or fighting when Amy and Ivan arrived at Amy's parents' house in Arkansas. What I find very interesting about this interview is that it is uncut and unedited, or at least it seems this way. He goes on to state that when Amy returned home after leaving Tawny's house, that's Ivan's ex-girlfriend, he states that Amy told him, and this is the quote, "He went back and killed her and took her to see the bodies." He says, "Amy was taken the next morning and someone kills Amy Kitchen." If I look at all of this and try to fit it together, I would speculate that Ivan and Amy were fighting about the clothes being thrown away in the trash can and not in the dumpster. Amy was upset about the bodies she had been shown that morning and not the night before, and had been told that the ring was Amy's sometime after they returned to the apartment to get their bags. It's my belief that Amy was taken to see the bodies the next morning and not the night of, and that would explain why she was okay that night to everyone they encountered, and why she was so happy and bubbly. Yes, the drugs helped, but I don't think she had seen the bodies just yet. Mr. Kramer says that Amy was reluctant to show the ring and didn't want to see it until Ivan grabbed her hand and showed everyone the ring on her finger. We have reason to believe this was most likely Amy's ring due to the written statements and interview of a man named Fernando. He was a patient at a dentist office where a few of the employees happened to be related to James Mosqueda. When he learned this, he told them that he had seen Ivan that night, and he had seen him in the Corvette the night of the murders. When he learned this, he told them he had seen Ivan, and he had been seen in the Corvette the night of the murders. The police were called, and he gives them a statement, which can be found in the binders. He even describes a ring on Amy's finger that is quite similar to the insurance description, which is also in the binder. At one point, Amy Betcher had a boyfriend in Minnesota named Mark Sargent, whose best friend shot him and then confessed to the murder, which was also related to drugs. I took the time to look into this, and this is information that I have shared with the other side, information that was ultimately ignored because it did not fit the narrative. Amy had nothing to do with that and was not involved, although this was brought up several times to try and damage her credibility and implicate her. Sylvia says she didn't want to call Ivan or leave a voicemail about James's death, but she still does this because Ivan calls her back 3:30 a.m. after receiving her message. When we look at photos of the crime scene, it looks to me as though James was moved based on the blood in the bed and the positioning of the pillows. Now, I know I don't have a lot of forensic experience or the credentials that other experts do, but I will say that I've spent countless hours poring over the photos of my father's murder, reading everything I can on blood spatter, and applying that knowledge here in this case. It has all turned out to be helpful and useful to me. I know that it's been said that Amy was shot on the side of the bed, was pulled across James and onto the floor next to the bed. However, I don't believe that this is what happened. To me, it looks like James was shot on the side of the bed and moved towards the middle for some reason. I can see this because of the positioning of the pillows on the bed and the blood spatter on the walls. I do believe James was sat on the edge of the bed while Amy sat on the tile of the bathroom right in front of the carpet in the bedroom. Amy Kitchen was probably there for a while and was most likely shot in the elbow as the other wounds were fatal. Several people have spoken about a puddle of blood in the bathroom right in front of the carpet but still on the tile. However, I have no photos of that, which isn't surprising to me after seeing sloppy or lazy detective work, and by the way, the information has slowly been drip-fed to me. As this wasn't a fatal shot, it was either to get their attention, to control them, or just a completely accidental firing of the gun by an inexperienced user. There was dry blood in Amy's other hand, and quite a bit still puddled in the palm of her hand, which looks to me like she had been holding her elbow as it bled. I do believe James was killed that night, but Amy, in my opinion, was killed the next morning before leaving to Arkansas. And that's when Amy Betcher saw the bodies and why everyone said she was acting fine all night. Ivan's excuse is simply that he has antisocial personality disorder with psychopathy, which is stated in several legal briefs. During this investigation and working with a producer from Cousins by Blood, I was given background checks on all the key players and suspects in this case. However, some had clearly been altered to remove information. These people do have criminal records, but it's mostly due to running large amounts of marijuana or DUIs. It's been suggested that Sylvia Cantu has a long history of fraud, fraudulent social security numbers and aliases. It's been suggested repeatedly that James was some mafioso kingpin drug dealer. However, he has no criminal history, and the people he kept company with do have records, but it's mostly involving marijuana. So while digging, it does seem that James and his friends may have been moving large amounts of marijuana at some point in time, but if we think of it in today's terms rather than 20 years ago, he could have been a successful dispensary owner in a legal state. He wouldn't be regarded as some low-life drug dealer that had it coming. James wasn't selling kids deadly and addictive drugs. He was selling pot to his friends in their circle. I know it's also been suggested that James's business office was broken into and ransacked after the murders. However, there is no record of this, and James's family denied this ever happened. While the rest of James's friend group was invited into his mortgage business, James's close friend, Carlos, has stated in prior interviews that this was just not a business that interested him. Instead, Carlos worked at a mall kiosk selling watches. Some of the watches he sold were actually knockoffs of expensive luxury brands, and sometimes Carlos's friends, including James, would buy these watches. I believe Ivan took a knockoff from James' home in his haste, by mistake. Hence the reason it was thrown out the window and called a shitty Rolex. In Amy Betcher's statement to the police, the word Rolex is in quotations. It looks like this was just an act Ivan put on for Amy, same as telling her that he was part of the mob or mafia, or that the cops worked for him, or that he was rich but had to act poor for mortgage scams. In my theory, Ivan tells Sylvia to go get her car from Anthony Fonseca at Carlos's home. Ivan tells Sylvia to do this during all this mess, after learning his cousin and his cousin's fiancé have been violently murdered in their home. It's just a strange thing to focus on. He tells Sylvia to go get her car, as Anthony had taken over payments after Ivan went to the Navy and went AWOL. The reason he gives Sylvia to go get her car is that Anthony and his friends are running drugs. Now, I don't think this is the truth, but this becomes the focus despite James's murder. So Sylvia and her sister Penny go to Carlos's house, where Anthony happens to also be living, and asks for the car and the keys. Carlos had met Ivan 3 years before the murders, when he bought Ivan's house to save it from foreclosure after Ivan spun out of control and lost everything. Sylvia claims not to know Carlos, though he went to many cookouts at Ivan's house. Sylvia was there, according to James's family, as James's family had been extended an invitation as well. So they know he was there and call Sylvia's claim nonsense. So, Sylvia goes to Carlos's house, where Ivan had once lived. After she gets there, Anthony opens the door. According to Sylvia, Anthony was supposed to be hunting. He had even invited James to go with him, though James was unable to, but came back early that morning after hearing of James and Amy's death, as did Carlos. Carlos coming from Waco. Waco is only an hour and 30-45 minutes away from this location, so it's not surprising that he was able to make it back home in time. And Anthony, doing a 5 to 7 hour trip in the middle of the night, it's not a stretch in Texas, especially not when it can take 24 hours just to get out of the state. While Carlos was in Waco, his wife was still at home, but goes and stays with family as she feels uncomfortable in Ivan's former house. So Carlos goes with her. Sylvia tells the story of Ivan telling her about the pizza man, and again puts it in her statement to the police. Sylvia also claims that a key on the key ring Anthony gave her supposedly went to the front door of Ivan and Amy's apartment. However, Ivan had given Sylvia the key to his apartment the night before, during their midnight meeting at IHOP. This was after she had taken the keys from Anthony Fonseca. I believe it slowly made its way onto Anthony Fonseca's key ring. Sylvia puts the key on the ring and tries it in Ivan and Amy Betcher's apartment door. But management had already had the locks changed, as Amy called to ask them to change the locks right away before she left for Arkansas. Amy Betcher has admitted to police and friends that she was afraid of both Sylvia and Penny. James's family have said that Sylvia did carry a small gun at the time, but it was because she's a female realtor, and they had been being attacked at house showings at the time. I've been unable to find any registrations for her for any firearms, but that doesn't mean that she did or didn't own one. I mean, it's not like Ivan registered the murder weapon, and Texas has some of the most lax firearm laws. Sylvia tells a story about Frank Perez, saying he was taking over the business and taking rent checks from James's house. Sylvia says Gladys took the checks from him and tells him to get the fuck out. However, in a recording of Sylvia translating Gladys's words for the podcast investigator, she mistranslates several things, such as telling Gladys that Amy Kitchen's brother took the heirloom Rolex off Amy's wrist after her death. For what reason? No one was even allowed into the home until close to midnight when the scene was cleared. Then Sylvia asked Gladys about the encounter with Frank Perez. But Gladys has no idea what Sylvia is talking about. Again, this recording will be available on our Facebook group and the Question the Case webpage. When the things Gladys says don't match up with what Sylvia is trying to portray to the investigator, she then tells the investigator that Gladys isn't feeling well and needs to go. Frank Perez wasn't a roommate. He was invited by James to come stay in his home to see if he liked the business and was good at it before moving his entire life to a new city. He would leave on the weekends to give them space and would go stay with friends and would do his laundry there. And this has been verified by all parties. In looking at the background checks, there is a Frank Perez Jr. that was in his 50s at the time and is not the same Frank Perez that was working with James. So it seems to me that this Frank Perez is another person that is being used as a scapegoat. Not only has it been alleged that Carlos and Anthony were responsible or had some part in their friend's murder, but now they're trying to pin it on Frank Perez. It feels like Ivan is throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks. In researching the background checks on Frank Perez, a Frank Perez Jr. and Frank Perez from Corpus Christi do pop up, but they're not the same person. There is mention of him using a sweater to not leave prints, which is nonsensical since, one, he stayed there, so his prints and DNA are already everywhere, and two, the scene had been processed and released, or else they wouldn't be allowed inside. and I know this from personal experience, so it wouldn't matter if he left more prints or used a sweater to open doors. Frank Perez is also still involved in the mortgage business, so if he had any part in James's death, he must be playing the long game. All of James's family have stated they know Ivan is guilty and provide a litany of reasons, such as these. Ivan told Carlos and Anthony that he was upset about Sylvia giving James all the business. Ivan was all over the place. He was in trouble for committing fraud. He was on large quantities of drugs constantly. And he didn't speak Spanish, which was needed to communicate with the clients. Ivan's friends all say he didn't sell drugs, but that he took them, and it was more than recreationally. It had become a problem. It's been alleged that someone came and kicked in Anthony Fonseca's door a few nights after the murder, but this was denied by Anthony himself. Carlos is quoted as saying, "Ivan's talent is that he could sell the dream. He was charismatic and enthusiastic." Carlos and Anthony have both talked about going to Jamaica with Ivan and Tawny and others shortly before the murder. And even then, he was searching for and doing drugs. Tawny was Ivan's on-again, off-again girlfriend who was 12 years his senior when he was 18, according to the police file. The cops were called to a domestic disturbance in which Ivan had thrown Tawny out of her apartment forcefully. Police showed up and made a report, which is also in the binder. Ivan and Tawny had just gone to Jamaica for Ivan's birthday, the summer of 2000, just months before the murder. Tawny also wrote a comment in 2017 insisting on Ivan's guilt, in all caps. And a screenshot will be posted on Facebook and the website. Tawny suddenly and recently believes in his innocence, in that Amy Betcher set Ivan up, but this is only true as of 2020, and only once the narrative was presented to her by an unethical investigator that Amy Betcher is the mastermind behind these murders. You can even hear this in her interviews on the Chasing Truth YouTube channel. I believe Tawny and Amy spoke about what happened that night, especially after listening to the mostly unedited interview on the YouTube channel Chasing Truth. Tawny references a conversation with Amy Betcher and says if someone were to do something that terrible to a woman, she would tell anyone. She claims her and Ivan left together that night. What is she talking about? What is the terrible thing? Is it being shot? Is it being beat up? Is there more? What does she know? She claims her and Ivan left together that night. She states to police that Ivan owed her $1,500 from their trip to Jamaica, and that's how much she took from Amy. Ivan makes it sound like he was in constant contact with Detective Wynn, but Wynn says it was a constant battle to speak with Ivan. Ivan only told Amy Betcher he was part of the mob and that the cops worked for him to keep her from calling the police, to keep her scared. Amy was in an abusive relationship, and Ivan had the gun on him the entire time from going over to James's house to leaving Tawny's to speak with Detective Wynn. Ivan is told the police have found and photographed a pair of jeans exactly like the ones found in the trash can in Ivan's closet. The same size, the same make, and the same brand. It's at this time that Ivan asks for a lawyer and ends the interview. The Corvette key is also found in his possession when they arrest him. Ivan calls Amy and Tawny to let them know he's being arrested around 4 p.m. and that the drugs, money, and gun were under the cushions. Ivan's arrest report states that he weighs 179 pounds at the time of his arrest. There is a photo of Ivan in Jamaica in the summer of 2000, not looking 140 pounds, and you can find this on Facebook and the website. You might be asking yourself, how can I be so sure of this statement? And it's because my dad was the same build that Ivan is claiming to be. My dad was 5'7", 5'8", between 135, 140 pounds since he was 18 years old till the day he was murdered. And Ivan simply doesn't fit that build. They say Ivan said it wasn't his first rodeo. Sylvia sent me a couple of scanned newspaper clippings that you can also find on Facebook and the website. The articles are about a couple of murders that took place near Ivan's home at the time and still remain unsolved. Like I said, my belief is that Ivan's stories and lies are based in some truth so that they can easily be remembered. I mean, why would Sylvia have kept these original newspaper clippings from six or more years prior to 2000? Why send them to the lawyers? It's because two men are still unidentified. Sylvia claimed to me that Ivan told her about the murders, and Carlos told Ivan about his involvement in the murders. Elsewhere, they say James told Ivan about the murders before he died. These are known as the Blackbird Lane murders and occurred 5 minutes away from Ivan's home. I have submitted a Freedom of Information request, but I have not heard back as of yet. In the jailhouse tapes, Ivan is heard badgering his mom, which people believe prove his innocence. Except that innocent and guilty people will continue to profess their innocence, especially when their life is on the line. Almost everyone in prison is innocent if you ask them. At one point in the conversation, Ivan says, and this is the direct quote, "You know what pisses me off? Is my only witness and key savior to this thing you guys didn't keep track of. You don't know where she's at. She should have been handcuffed at your house." Ivan is immediately interrupted by his mother and Aunt Penny. They say, "We don't need to be talking about that, Ivan. This is all recorded." So was he talking about Amy Betcher? Ivan also asks, "Was it open casket or closed?" And when he's told it's an open casket, he only says, "Okay," but you can hear the disappointment in his voice. Why? Looking at the photos sent by the Dallas Police Department in the coroner's office, Amy's face clearly looks beat up. Her eyes are swollen with blood running down her face from her nose, as if she had been standing and had a nosebleed, not face down on the carpet, which would have taken a different path and dried differently on her face and the floor. I think Ivan asked this because he was hoping the shot to her head had destroyed her face, just like you might see in some movie. And he was hoping that it would simultaneously destroy evidence of a beating, or maybe what occurred that night. But it didn't, and you can hear Ivan's disappointment. Even Tawny says in her interviews on Chasing Truth YouTube channel, "I'd be telling everyone if you know someone did that to a woman." Amy may have known and said nothing to Tawny. "I might as well put a plastic bag over my head and commit suicide," Ivan says. Ivan has a history of physical and verbal abuse, including sexual assault. His wife testified at trial, and it came to light that he was still married at the time of trial. When I asked Sylvia about this, she asked me if this is the same little girl that liked to be beat up. And this recording will also be provided in the usual places because I wouldn't believe it if I hadn't heard it with my own ears. Ivan taking the IDs comes into question. Ivan supporters think it's a hit based off of what they've seen on TV and in the movies, which to me is exactly why he took it. He repeatedly talks about Pulp Fiction, Steven Seagal, and every mafia trope you can think of. Ivan has many people that are his victims, not just the ones he's killed. He has taken advantage of so many people. Ivan has people that are his victims, aside from James and Amy, and the woman he calls his current wife, Tammy, despite zero marriage certificate, his mother, his brother, his supporters. On another note, the Innocence Project has reviewed this case and said this is not a DNA case. At one point, I offered Ivan's current wife, Tammy Cantu, help with the DNA, but continuously received the runaround. And this was also witnessed by many on the Facebook Cousins by Blood group when it still existed before it was deleted. At one point, I offered help publicly, but she continued to give excuses. This story has continuously changed. And after speaking to loved ones and friends, I was presented with a history of abuse, drug abuse, theft, and fraud. Ivan's wife even went as far as writing to my mother in prison to try and put a stop to this podcast. In any case, the Rolex, the ring, and the Corvette, they don't make one bit of difference to the sentence Ivan received of capital punishment. Yes, a robbery during the commission of a murder or similar felony can be charged as capital murder, but so can the murder of more than one person. At the end of the day, Ivan killed two people, his own blood relative, while they were in the security of their own home. That is considered an offense in and of itself that is worthy of the death penalty in the state of Texas. Ivan, his wife, and sometimes his mother repeatedly say he's not guilty of capital murder, but not that he's innocent. Even his lawyers said in closing arguments that Ivan is not guilty of capital murder, but never that he was wrongfully accused and convicted or completely innocent. After many meetings with his lawyers, discussing trial strategy with them, Ivan gets angry and demands that his lawyers use his own strategy. Ivan finally explodes and tells both of his lawyers and his mitigation expert that it doesn't matter that he did it. It is their job to get him off. You can find all of this in the ineffective assistance of counsel response written and submitted to the appellate court by Geller, his trial lawyer. Ivan tells both his lawyers and mitigation expert that the murders were in response to a drug deal. According to Ivan, James sold some coke or marijuana that Ivan had provided, but didn't give Ivan what Ivan felt was his fair cut. So Ivan goes and kills his own cousin and cousin's fiance in cold blood. Ivan would give up anyone to save his ass. And the only people I think of that he would sit on death row for 20 years for would maybe be his immediate family. His mother, his brother, maybe his aunt. Ivan's little brother had just gotten out of prison a night or two before the murders and was battling heroin addiction. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that drug addiction or previous arrest makes a murderer, but it does shine a little light on the situation, and it certainly gives me pause. Especially when you take into account my own experience with my parents' case and what I truly believe happened to my dad. To try and prove reasonable doubt at this stage is pointless, though I wish that wasn't so. Detective Wynn says they didn't look at computer forensics, but there is a report, and you can find it in the case binders. This report did not find anything of any importance on the desktop computer in James and Amy Kitchen's home. With what I know of Ivan, and as I've already said, he sticks to the truth, even when making up lies. It always seems to be based in some morsel of truth, so the truth is somewhere in these stories and lies that Ivan has told. In one of Ivan's appeals, it gives a great rundown of the trial strategy and why certain choices were made. We know that people in Ivan's life were not called, and Ivan and his supporters are very upset by this. Both the defense and prosecution cannot call a person they know or suspect is going to lie. Tawny had to go back and amend her original statement to the police to say that she did find money under the sofa cushions, along with the drugs, the gun, and the bullets. This can also be found in the binders on our website and Facebook group. Tawny lied in her statements, therefore discrediting herself in the eyes of the defense and prosecution. Had the defense called Sylvia, the prosecution would have discredited her by stating that Sylvia lied about Ivan living with her for 3 months when he went AWOL with the Navy. If only they had known just how much was being hidden. Lawyers also cannot ask a witness about what someone else said or what someone may have heard. It's all hearsay and inadmissible in court, with very few exceptions, such as something called an excited utterance, which is not applicable here. I know this not only from researching, but also because this was my experience while testifying during my parents' trial. No hearsay is allowed apart from what I've just mentioned. When we look objectively at these people, who is it that they could have possibly called? Ivan's mother, Sylvia, whom had already been proven as someone that would lie for her son? His ex-girlfriend, Tawny, that proved she would do the same? His family, who turned against him because they know in their hearts that he is the murderer? Who does that leave? Especially when a lawyer cannot call a witness they know will elicit perjury. Ivan has continuously made the claim that he had ineffective assistance of counsel, but it is hard to see the things in the way Ivan sees them, as slights or some vast and convoluted conspiracy against him. It does seem as though Ivan had planned this well in advance, as Amy B's brother, Jeff, had been asked if he would like to join the cleanup crew a month prior, and was then told to read the newspaper once a story had been published regarding the murders. It seems to me this trip to Arkansas was their alibi, as they were in Arkansas when the bodies were discovered. There was no evidence of forced entry at the Mosqueda and Kitchen home, which leads me to believe it was someone they knew if they were allowed entry into their home, especially so late at night. It was around 11 p.m. after arriving home from eating dinner with Amy Kitchen's father. Two sets of keys, which contained the keys to the car and the home of James and Amy Kitchen, were found at Ivan's apartment. The murder weapon was found at Tawny's apartment, Ivan's ex-girlfriend, and his fingerprints were on the magazine of the gun, which I have photos of and will be posting in the usual places. His prints were taken several times and analyzed by several different experts, all who say Ivan's prints match the fingerprints found on the magazine of the gun. Ivan Cantu has repeatedly denied any requests by his counsel to be psychologically evaluated. He finally gave in and hired a psychologist to do so later down the line. It was found that Ivan may suffer from multiple overlapping indicators and may suffer from organic brain damage or a severe mood-altering disorder. They believe that if a health professional had reviewed Ivan Cantu's family history and evaluated him prior to the sentencing phase of his trial, that any reasonably competent psychiatric professional would have recognized the need to subject Ivan to a complete neurological-psychological evaluation. Ivan's counsel stated, "Every time Ivan used a stimulant, he became abusive, and in the months prior to the murders, he had moved into a manic phase and began to use crank, ecstasy, and speed. which interact with a bipolar disorder to cause difficult and unpredictable behavior, irritability, agitation, and cause biological and chemical malfunctions to escalate. Matthew Geller, Ivan's lead trial counsel, testified by affidavit that he and his co-counsel, Don High, had decided not to have Ivan complete a neuropsychological evaluation for three main reasons. One, Ivan did not want to participate in this mitigation evidence. Two, they did not believe that Ivan would receive a favorable psychiatric report based on the fact that he had admitted to them that he had killed Mosqueda in Kitchen out of revenge because James owed him drug money. And three, the state had evidence of Ivan's prior violent acts against women. Ivan has a history of abusive conduct towards his two ex-wives and Amy Betcher that we know of, which involved him flying into a rage, firing shots at them, beating them, or raping them. There is also testimony from several different people in which Ivan attempted to physically abuse his mother, Sylvia, on several occasions and in front of witnesses. During these instances, it was James that would come play referee and try to talk Ivan down. This, coupled with the particularly gruesome nature of the execution style of the instant murders, led Ivan's counsel to believe that a state-sponsored psychiatric evaluation could indicate that Ivan was a sociopath, which would lower their already slim chance for a life sentence, especially when considering that Ivan was indicted for the murder of two people that were at home in their own bed. If psychological evaluation proved Ivan to be a sociopath, then Ivan would have been considered a future danger, which would undermine the mitigating evidence they intend to submit in support of a life sentence. Ivan was manipulative and had lied on several occasions to his own counsel, Matt Geller says. He continued to explain that Ivan had suggested his counsel elicit perjured testimony, and they feared that a psychological exam might lead to findings of manipulation, which is a commonly sought theme in the punishment phase. Geller had attested that after 17 years as a practicing attorney, he was well acquainted with bipolar disorders, effects, and symptoms, and that both he and Don High had no evidence to support the theory that Ivan was suffering from any kind of mental deficiency, and in particular, a bipolar disorder. It was then found that Ivan Cantu's trial counsel decision not to investigate his mental health was entirely reasonable. It's also clear that the state court could refuse to consider the merits of Ivan's unexhausted claim of ineffective assistance of counsel at the conviction phase. To mount a credible claim of innocence, an applicant has to support his allegations of constitutional error with reliable evidence. This evidence can be exculpatory scientific evidence, trustworthy eyewitness accounts, or critical physical evidence that was not presented at trial. To determine whether an applicant has satisfied this burden, the court has to make a comprehensive evaluation of all evidence, old and new, incriminating and exculpatory, without regard to whether it would necessarily be admitted under the rules or admissibility at trial. They must then decide how reasonable jurors that were properly instructed would react to the overall newly supplemented record. Ivan claims that his counsel rendered ineffective assistance by failing to investigate evidence of his innocence and present it at trial. In particular, Ivan points to three factual inconsistencies that were admitted into evidence at trial. One, the telephone records that indicate that someone made a phone call from Ivan's apartment on the night after the murder when he and Amy Betcher were in Arkansas, while his mother and the police were there doing the well check. Two, toll tag records, which indicated that someone drove James Mosqueda's Corvette at 11:15 a.m. on November 4th, even though Ivan claims the last time they drove the car was at 6:30 a.m., and three, the state's blood spatter expert testified, based on photos of the crime scene, that Amy Kitchen had been punched or kicked in the face, while the doctor that had performed the autopsy found no evidence of injuries to the victims apart from the gunshot wounds. However, Ivan does not explain how this evidence proves his innocence. The district court pointed out that there are rational explanations for these inconsistencies that a reasonable juror could accept. The fact that another person had access to Ivan's house would not lead a rational person to disbelieve the evidence that Ivan committed the murders. Similarly, a rational juror would likely conclude that it was Ivan himself that drove James's car at 11:15 a.m. on November 4th, 2000, and that he left for Arkansas shortly after. Finally, although Ivan is correct that Amy Kitchen's autopsy report does not report that she suffered any facial trauma other than the gunshot wound, the trauma is clearly visible in the autopsy photos themselves. A rational juror would likely conclude that the autopsy report on Amy Kitchens was less detailed than it could have been, not that Ivan didn't kill her. Ivan alleges that These inconsistencies support the conclusion that he was framed by the rival drug dealers truly responsible for James Mosqueda's murder. This evidence does not undermine the incriminating evidence that was admitted at trial. Furthermore, an officer testified that Ivan's mother placed a call using Ivan's home phone at about the time when they were with her at the apartment. And in conversations with me, she has let me know that they did drive the Corvette after 6:30 a.m. and had to return it by noon.
Because it was getting close to be 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and they were still at Smiley's house, or Metals.
She said Metals. That they got home by 10.
Yeah, and she's worried because her parents are expecting her, and they're not even on the road yet. So they had to get the vet back to James.
Which would have triggered a toll hit before leaving for Arkansas. Ivan's trial counsel, Geller and High, agreed that the best strategy was to hone in on 4 points. 1, Ivan's dysfunctional childhood and family. 2, Ivan's misuse of drugs and alcohol. 3, Ivan's lack of future dangerousness when drugs and alcohol were removed from his access, i.e. a plea for a life sentence. And 4, Ivan's recent spiritual conversion experience after being incarcerated, making him a born-again Christian, thereby reducing the likelihood for future violence and filling the void brought about by the now-missing drugs and alcohol. Ivan further contends that his counsel rendered deficient performance in 3 ways. 1, by failing to interview Ivan's ex-girlfriend, Tawny, at whose apartment police found the murder weapon, which again would elicit perjury. 2, by failing to question the state's witnesses as to whether Ivan's face was indeed swollen and whether his hand was indeed injured, as Amy Butcher testified. And 3, by conceding Ivan's culpability for the murders during closing arguments. These claims do not constitute reliable evidence, let alone new evidence, and therefore cannot support Ivan's claim of actual innocence. In short, the appellate court ruled that the district court was correct, that the state court could clearly refuse the merits of this claim if it were now presented in a successive state petition for post-conviction relief. Again, thank you so much for your patience and participation in this convoluted case. This case has been such a roller coaster of emotion, and it's really made me question so many more aspects of our justice system, as well as the death penalty as a whole. I wish we could do more for Ivan, because although we couldn't find mercy for James and Amy, I would love if we could find some for Ivan, though it's doubtful he's deserving of it based on his recent actions and the trauma he continues to cause his family and the family of James Mosqueda and Amy Kitchen. I'm tired of people needlessly losing their lives, and I'm tired of an eye-for-an-eye mentality, but this is the system in place, and this is the punishment Ivan is facing. All because of his poor choices and belief that he would not face consequences, or that he could talk his way out of them. No one is responsible for what is happening to Ivan except for Ivan himself. This is not a grand conspiracy. It's not even a wrongful conviction. These are the consequences of Ivan's own selfish actions. On August 17th of 2021, Ivan was sent to Collin County for a hearing regarding the DNA testing of Amy Kitchen's fingernail scrapings. Matt Duff, or Wayne Dunn, Ivan's mother, Sylvia, his father, Abner, and his brother, Eric, along with 5 other supporters, were present for the hearing. As for the results, nothing was found that incriminates or exonerates Ivan. The court stated that had these results been available at the time of trial in 2001, Ivan Cantu would have still been convicted for these murders. Gina Bunn, Ivan's current attorney, was asked if she had any new evidence she would like to present to the court. Ms. Bunn replied that she had nothing new to present or submit, which is strange, as Ivan and the Cousins by Blood podcast continue to claim they have new fingerprint evidence, possible suspects, and affidavits from credible witnesses, including an affidavit from one of the original responding officers, all supporting Ivan's innocence. It seems to me, if this was the case, this would have been the perfect opportunity to present it. The DA's office believes Ivan's attorney will not appeal these results, as she hasn't in the past. Ivan is now on the DA's radar. Time is nearly up. They should not be hesitating if there truly is evidence of a wrongful conviction. This is Ivan's story and my personal take. Next week, you'll hear an interview with Tina Church, who is one of the private investigators on this case. Tina was hired by Tammy Cantu, the woman currently in a relationship with Ivan, and has a reputation that precedes her, due to the work she does for death row inmates. We'll discuss this case in more detail and her thoughts on the matter. Thank you so much for joining us again, and I hope to see you back again next week as we continue to question the case. to Shane Yoder for music and sound engineering, Stephanie Davies for research and investigating, Chasing Truth YouTube channel, and Cousins by Blood podcast.